I'm Max Goller, and we're here with the inaugural Sacred Legions podcast, and I'm joined by my partner, Pat LaMarche.
Hi there. Hey, Max. Hey, Max. What's a Sacred Legion?
Okay, so Sacred Legions, the idea behind it came from a patron saint of ours, Kurt Vonnegut, the author, and he had this concept that people doing decent things, living decently in a completely indecent world, needed to be recognized as secular saints. And the podcast is designed to acknowledge and recognize important people that are secular saints, that are doing decent things.
Are you saying that we're living in indecent times? Is that what I'm hearing?
There's a good possibility that that might be seen as existing in the world. But the most important thing is, with this podcast, that we are going to recognize the people who are doing the decent things. We're going to focus on the positive.
So why did you pick the term secular saint? Why did you pick Sacred Legions instead of using secular saint?
So the podcast name, Sacred Legions, I won't deny, comes from a pun, because if you put the two words together, sacred and legions, and treat them as one word, it actually comes out as kind of sounding like sacrilegion.
That is so cool.
So the idea behind this then is that we are recognizing people that are our secular saints, that are doing things that we feel are decent in the world.
And that's sacrilegious. And that's beautiful.
And there are people that would not agree with us. So
yeah.
I think that we have to define what a secular saint is based on what is decent for other human beings.
That's brilliant. Why did you never tell me that's where it comes from before? Because that is really brilliant.
I thought I had told you that. Glad that we've got that out in the air.
And so, so it's a sacrilege to have your guest here tonight that you're about to introduce?
Not to me, it's not. I mean, it might be to some people that,
you mean
that
people,
I would be the sacrilegious person. But
you mean
it's not
people who
me.
Say, drill, baby, drill? It's a sacrilege to have this guest on?
Absolutely. Anybody that isn't a secular saint, in my opinion, would probably be objecting. So.
Okay. So I'll let you introduce your guest now.
Indeed. So I have with me Christina Jarvis, who is the author of Lucky Mud and Other FOMA, A Field Guide to Kurt Vonnegut's Environmentalism and Planetary Citizenship. And so I met you while I was director of the Kurt Vonnegut Museum and Library in Indianapolis. And I wanted to have you be involved in a teaching Vonnegut program that I did, because I recognized that your scholarship on Kurt Vonnegut was so much deeper than any of the other scholars I'd worked with. And I got to work with quite a lot of Vonnegut scholars in the time that I was director of education. But your just innate knowledge of Kurt Vonnegut impressed me so much that I knew that I needed you to be in the Teaching Vonnegut program.
So, Christina Jarvis, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much. And Pat and Max, thank you for having me. I just have to say that I am deeply honored to be the first guest on this program honoring secular saints. And you're talking about sacrilegious, though. I think there are a lot of nuns in Notre Dame High School that are probably saying that she was not so saintly and might not be the best choice, but I am still honored.
Excellent.
I'm honored to be on the show.
So how did you meet Max? I mean, we heard that Max met you there, but were you in a Teaching Vonnegut class or something?
No. So I won't give you the whole story, but I had gone to the Lilly Library to do some research for Lucky Mud and Other FOMA, but of course, being a total Vonnegut nerd, I had timed my visit to coincide with, you know, February 13th, the firebombing of Dresden, and there was an event up in Indianapolis about Slaughterhouse-Five, and I went to that, and Max was talking about teaching the Vonnegut, and the second I heard it, I was like, can I do Galapagos? And that isn't exactly the novel that most people want to have, so I kind of wormed my way in.
Right. And so for people who don't know, the bombing of Dresden matters because Kurt Vonnegut was a prisoner of war in Dresden at the time of the bombing, and it informed his most famous book, which was Slaughterhouse-Five.
Absolutely.
Sorry. So
I was going to point out that this event that we had for Slaughterhouse-Five Day, the bombing of Dresden Day, was actually held in a church. So I still think that there's some validity to saying that this is a holy thing that we're engaged in. So I'm proud of that.
Or a sacrilegious thing. I'm still willing to go either way.
Yes.
So you were together for this thing, and you talked to each other, and then you just started this friendship, or what happened from there? How did you find out she was a secular saint?
Well, in getting to talk to her, the level of her Vonnegut knowledge was so deep. Like I say, it impressed me beyond anybody I'd ever dealt with before. And I was always on the look for people to do the teaching Vonnegut course. And so we were looking for scholars, people that were already in teaching, that could come in and they could share their knowledge with other teachers so that they could teach Vonnegut more effectively.
So now we fast forward to you guys becoming fabulous friends, which I understand because Max and I met in a similar way and walked into the library. But you announced just before we went on the air that you actually started your book with an acknowledgement of secular saints. So do you want to tell us about that?
Yes. So I'm very honored to be on this podcast because the idea of secular sainthood has been a driving force for my own way of living, for approaching Vonnegut. I just have to say that his secular humanism has always been very important to me. So it's a bit of a deep connection there. But I did want to share the part of, you know, when you're an author and you do readings, I could tell you the one thing no one will ever ask you to read is your acknowledgments, but this is like the one singular situation where it will make sense. So I was just going to read the very beginning of this because I think it captures the sort of web of support and goodness that I see as associated with Kurt Vonnegut, and that I think you're trying to bring in honoring all of the sort of decent civic wonderful human and humane acts that people give. So if you'll humor me in letting me read a few words from the acknowledgments, which were just such a joy to write, I will begin. And I think the listeners will see it does tie into the podcast. But from my acknowledgments, toward the end of his career, Vonnegut often said one of the things that made life worth living was all the secular saints he got to meet. Perhaps it's a Kurt thing, or maybe I'm just some extra lucky mud, but writing this book has brought numerous secular saints into my life. Following Mary Kathleen O'Looney's example in Jailbird, I've tried to keep track of them. One of the greatest joys has been working with other Vonnegut scholars and artists, especially members of Kurt's own carass. Whether answering questions, sharing stories and materials, or nurturing my projects, Mark Leeds, Asa Perot, Jerome Klinkowitz, Robert Whitey, and Joe Petro III have redefined generosity and lived up to Kurt's praise in Timequake. Joel Cohen, also known as the Sticker Dude, helped me appreciate Kurt's social justice legacies and mail art, while librarian Dan Crocker unearthed countless periodical gems. And I go from there to just acknowledge Dan Wakefield and Dan Simon and so many members of Kurt's own carass. And for people who are listening who aren't Vonnegut fans, that just means an association of people, a connection. But what I wanted to really emphasize, and I think that the podcast really gets at, is that when you are open to Vonnegut's ideas about behaving decently, honoring, you know, again, that idea of behaving decently in an indecent society, you're just open to meeting so many other good-minded people. And so for that reason, it is such a great honor because I think it honors Kurt's legacy as well.
So do you have a good-minded person with you?
I do. Should I introduce him?
You think so, Max?
Well, yeah, and I was going to say that we've got another person for this interview that's not been involved yet. I think it would be appropriate here to introduce the guest that you brought on. So part of the format that will be going on with Sacred Legions is we will ask the person that we want to interview if they have someone that they feel shares their passion for, in this case, environmentalism, and bring them in along with them. So please introduce.
Yes. So I am here with my husband, Thomas Neer, who is a secular saint, an artist, an environmentalist, and just wonderful person in his own right. And I just have to say, Kurt said that basically to practice an art, no matter how well or how badly, it'll make your soul grow. But he thought that what might save us is the creation and appreciation of art. So I'm very lucky that I have saving me constantly my husband, Tom, but he deserves a medal for putting up with me for the almost decade that it took researching and writing this book. He had to live Kurt Vonnegut. He had to, you know, just be immersed and go along with so much of the wackiness. But I did want to acknowledge that he really embodies so much of what I value about Kurt as well, his planetary citizenship, his social justice concerns, his champion of the arts as well.
You want to say hi, Tom?
Hey, everybody.
Welcome to the show, Tom.
I will say Kurt's way funnier than I am.
He's funnier than we all are.
Yes.
He's got spades.
We got rid of the bar for Kurt. We lowered it long ago.
Yeah. Yeah, to say I lived this book, when you read the book, I lived every page of that book through our morning dog walks as we discussed stuff and editing and what got cut and a variety of things. So it's fun. It's amazing. Christina, like her knowledge, her deep knowledge, you saw it earlier today where like she remembered the present I gave her for her 33rd birthday. You know, wow.
Okay. Well, wait a minute. What was it?
Honey, what was it?
It was a copy of Wampeter's FOMA and Grand Falloon, of course.
Who could forget that?
Of course, right? Yeah.
Of course. Morning,
she's only human.
Doesn't
she's
everyone?
She's like, well, you inscribed something in it. Like, yeah, you did. But yeah, it's...
How well did you know her when she was 33?
We were married.
Oh, yeah. And so you thought, I know the exact thing this woman would love to have.
Mm-hmm. Plus, I think I read a couple excerpts from it, because it's a bunch of short stories, if I remember correctly.
No, that's the essays.
Oh, that's the essays. Okay.
Yeah. I write the books.
Yeah.
He lives with me while I write them.
Yeah. So what's your environmental tie? What's your deal? What's your gig?
Well, I paint trees and I plant trees. And I'm an Eagle Scout through and through.
So as an artist, you paint pictures of trees.
Yeah, I paint landscapes.
You don't go down into the forest and just turn them all purple?
Nope.
I was going to say, he's doing a very good job. Yeah. Where
the writers in the room were like, where's your modifier going here? Yeah. But
No, but we... I mistakenly went to our town's bicentennial meeting and... because we want to do an art show about the artists and the history of the arts in the town that we live in. And somebody said, we should plant a bicentennial tree. And I said, a tree? That seems kind of, you know, unambitious. How about 200 trees? So there, the Bicentennial Tree Project was born, and we planted 232 trees.
Wow.
We sold them as a fundraiser for the bicentennial and planted them and came out. And then that was the beginning of our tree planting adventure. But Christina, whenever she would travel to do any research for the book, she would always offset it. She would do carbon offsets, either by paying people to plant trees or by planting trees herself. She incorporated it into her classes. She's worked with the Greystone Nature Preserve up in Brockton, and she's got a literary grove up there, and just it's amazing. But
that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, what a great idea.
That's
a great idea, yeah.
If I may wear my Vonnegut nerddom on my sleeve, which will be, you know, in the fourth dimension for all your listeners because they can't see us. The very first tree of the offset trees was for Jane Vonnegut, who herself was an amazing secular saint. And honestly, we would not have Kurt Vonnegut's work without Jane, but I planted it with a view of like Erie, because there's a beautiful passage in Time Quake where, you know, Jane actually passed away from cancer, for people who don't know.
And Jane is his first wife.
His first wife. Yes. Yes. But because of there's a beautiful passage where he said, and there will be a sunburned rafish boy skipping stones, and when that stone hits the water, that will be the moment when you will pass. And he expresses this deep love, even though they had been divorced. So the first tree was for Jane, but then I planted a tree for Kurt, a tulip tree, because that's the Indiana state tree. But then when they were first engaged, while they were in college, he gave her a copy of Thoreau's collected works. And he described an oak and their children and Thoreau's work. And so planted an oak for Jane. And then I planted a white pine for Thoreau, because that was the predominant tree around Lake Max and Cucky where
he
went.
Trees ain't cheap.
Yeah, no, but so I planted, and then I planted one for Joseph Heller, because he was friends with Kurt. So every tree was not only
Catch 22,
which was why I actually became an English major. But it was more than just offsetting the miles. It was actually, you know, planting trees that were meaningful and honored their legacy. And then that actually grew into a whole literary grove honoring other writers, and then actually a memorial grove. So it just kind of happened organically, but it all sprung from, you know, my own planetary citizenship, which probably led to me wanting to write about Kurt's environmental and social justice engagements in the first place.
I want to bring it back around, too, because the focus of Sacred Legions, Kurt Vonnegut acts as a patron saint for the whole thing because of him defining what a secular saint was. But if you go to the website, you're going to see there are several categories of what is recognized as secular sainthood. And one of those is global stewardship, which is what I brought Christina in for. When you came out to Carlisle to do an Earth Day event for us, which was actually an interruption of your normal Earth Day plans to do the clean up the beach thing that you do every year at Earth Day. We brought you out to Carlisle to do an event, and that's when I realized just how passionate you were about the environment. So, and in discussing this with you over dinner last night, you mentioned where that came from and how it connected to Vonnegut. So what was that?
Sorry to be total Vonnegut nerd, but all these sort of tendrils connect. So one of the reasons that I got interested in doing Kurt Vonnegut's environmental and social justice engagements was because I found out that he spoke at the first Earth Day. And that was not something that most people think about with Kurt Vonnegut. But probably the piece that preceded that, my own mom, Pat Jarvis, to whom partially the book was dedicated, was involved in the first Earth Day as well, but not in New York City. Kurt spoke in Bryant Park. My mom was in the town hall at the fire department in Monroe County, Pennsylvania, and there was no recycling back in 1970. And so she and a group of women in the community got together, and they tabled and raised environmental awareness, and they actually started the first recycling program in my county. So my mom was the first not only planetary citizen in my life, you know, we were always growing our own food, and she was a manic recycler, but she was also the first Vonnegut person in my life. It was honestly her books that I stole. I stole from my brother, yeah. But they were her books. So she was a Vonnegut fan and also obviously a huge environmentalist as well. So it all is connected.
So maybe planetary stewardship should be renamed manic recyclers. That's fabulous.
That's a good characteristic of it.
Yeah. You know, some people take it as seriously as a religious practice.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, why would you throw something away that can be reduced, reused, or recycled?
Yeah, it's there's the guilt, you know? Like, if you don't recycle, there's, like, Catholic guilt. There's, like, eco-guilt.
You know. Like guilt work for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you go home at the end of the day and you say, and I do think this is what defines you. Now, this is my opinion of what defines you as a secular saint, is a person who writes a book and then tries to offset all the carbon for it, which I am now feeling guilty myself that of all my books, I've never offset a single bit of the carbon. And you go home and you say, hun, I know that you're really into recycling, but I want to buy $1,000 worth of trees. This is just okay in your house because that's a commitment you make to the world.
And I want to bring up the point, too, that the family connections came through really strongly in talking to you. So the two of you together, if you want to talk to me about, there was your mother's influence on you, but then how did that go through the next generation and on to the next generation after that in your family?
So with the tree project, again, it was, we brought in a lot of community groups. And at the time, my boys were just getting in, or our boys were just getting involved with Scouts. And so I think both of our boys planted, together we planted like 82 trees out of the 230 of them. But getting their fingers dirty, getting them fingers into the earth and having that, like they can walk around our community and see all of the trees they planted. One of the best things for Christina's students, when they come back to school, there's not really a lot of college that they did. Everything they did is like really temporary, but they can go back to the Greystone Nature Preserve and see Bill and Diane and see the tree that they helped plant. You know, so planting trees, especially around campuses. In our community, we have a lot of maples that are 100 and 120 years old and that are dying and need to be replanted. And if you leave it up to the villages and the local governments, they're going to plant some trees that are not native. They're easy maintenance trees that look pretty and flower, but are just, we're losing our color is essentially what I'm getting at. And if we're not stewards of the viewshed and really think about this, another problem, we live in maple sugar land. There's enough things that happen with that. But if we're not planting, replacing maple trees that come down, where's the syrup going to come from? Kind of thing. You know, and yeah, you can get imitation syrup, but it's not the same. But also the color. I mean, we drove all over the county today, and fall is peaking, and it's so beautiful. And it's those reds and oranges that come from the maples that are absolutely spectacular.
And I love how that artist sensibility is coming in here, too. You look at views all the time and do many, many landscape paintings that I was admiring in your studio even last night. And developing that environmental passion through another passion that you have, I think, is beautiful.
Yeah. Plus, then you get back to the beach cleanups. It's amazing. And, Christina, I'm going to let you talk about this because that's like the research that you guys – what's the project you've been part of?
The International Coastal Cleanup and Adopt a Beach. But I am going to bring it back to Kurt a little bit, tie the Sanukas together. Another little vended or shove. There were actually drafts of his 1973 novel, Breakfast of Champions, where the Great Lakes disappeared under plastic pollution. It doesn't appear in the novel. It was one of the reasons I got interested. But we live just a couple miles from Lake Erie. You know, Kurt wrote stories and was deeply concerned about that. So we have been involved in doing beach cleanups, usually around Earth Day, but then also in the fall for 15 years or so, but community projects. And I did want to emphasize the focus on community. So although I feel like I'm kind of we're personally taking credit for a lot of these events, but I really feel that we've both been, it's been the community we've been connected to, you know, and community is also sacred in Kurt Vonnegut. And so it's really bringing people together. You know, I also used to work, and I'm going to give a shout out to a colleague, Sam Mason, who actually got rid of, she was instrumental in doing the first Great Lakes plastic pollution studies and getting rid of microplastics. You know, so some of the data from our beach cleanups, but she and I used to coordinate Earth Week at our college, and we would have teach-ins and, you know, getting rid of plastic bags and CFL giveaways. We brought in Ralph Nader and did all kinds of programming. But it was really about connecting people and going back to those grassroots days. I mean, the first Earth Day brought out 20 million people. And Kurt Vonnegut, when he spoke, he talked about these litter-collecting saints. Keep bringing it back to saints. But Earth Week was organic, and it was just because of everyday individual people like my mom and those women in the Monroe County Fire Hall doing basic good things. And that's really what I love about Kurt Vonnegut. you know, that emphasis on human communities, championing the arts. And really, I hate to take credit as an individual for it, because I really just helped create and connect different groups and help it flow together.
Well, you're making a really good point that Max has really worked into the whole Secular Saints, Sacred Legions website and podcast idea. Is every one of you secular saints knows another secular saint. And so part of the network is to have you rat out this woman who did this stuff with you so that she can then be maybe the next person or a person 6 months from now that gets a little focus so that we know about her secular sainthood. But also people who are interested can contact the website and they can recommend people and they can recommend agencies that they think really are doing the good work in their community. And Max, you're going to make a clearinghouse where people can go to the website and they can access information about these other agencies, right?
So the function of the website, a part of the interview is going to be to get recommendations from everybody we interview. What is an organization that deserves volunteer service, or what is an organization that provides good self-care? So if you're unhoused, how do you get help with that? If you're having issues with mental illness or anything like that, where do you get help for that? So the website is going to be a growing resource for those things that people need help with. And with the volunteerism, it's you as the listeners. This is your opportunity to become a secular saint yourself, to be inspired to do what you're passionate about that is decent in an otherwise indecent world.
Or maybe you've been doing it for 20 years. Just let us know what it is. You know.
Absolutely.
I got to say, the small things matter. It's like the little things. Taking your kids out to do these things, teaching your kids in the next generation. But the little things really matter. Being out there and picking up the plastic on the beach and seeing what it is that's out there. And then asking yourself, hey, why is this in the water? Oh, it's because our water filtration plant doesn't catch this. Well, how do we fix that? And then asking our government officials and really expect more.
Yeah.
This might be a good point, too, to bring in. So we talked about your mother's generation. We talked about you and your husband's generation. What about your children? You've got two children. Where do you see them in this environmental journey as it continues?
Well, that is like the gift question. What parent does not love to brag about their children? but of course, we have an artist and an English professor, writer, and we have two engineers.
Oh, excellent. The other half of the brain is all on fire.
Yeah. One, our younger son, is a nuclear engineering major, and he wants to work on fusion.
Awesome.
You know, a wonderful renewable energy site. And our older son is actually an industrial and systems engineer. He's in a master's program now, but he is doing a lot of work to big picture help develop systems to not only resettle climate refugees, but capture and reduce the carbon intensity of manufacturing processes, also develop apps to recycle metals and create more reuse ends. So they are both inspiring planetary citizens in their own right. And I would love to give Kurt credit, but they did a lot through Scouts that Tom really encouraged and, you know, in terms of connecting to community.
Well, it's interesting because it seems as though they had this excellent leadership at home that said, I'm on the ground, I'm cleaning the beach, I know the plastic doesn't belong here, I know that shouldn't have made it through the filters, I know we shouldn't have thrown it there in the first place. And so I have this theory, it's called the Captain Kirk theory of the environment, and that's that we can destroy the planet and we'll just go into the past, grab a couple of whales, bring them into the future and save all the problems, right? Which is what they do on Star Trek. But that's not the solution. But there will absolutely necessarily be solutions that engineers will find for some of the damage we've done that we can't go back in time and undo. So they've got these, I'm putting my hands on this tiny problem right now, people, in their house. I'm planting a tree. It sounds small, but it's a big difference. 100 pounds of oxygen a year for a mature tree. But I'm also going to make sure that I find the solution going down the road. What does happen? Jakarta has moved 30, is it 30 miles? Jakarta has been moved, the city center, away from the shore because it's going to be underwater by 2050. A whole city. And that's way more forward thinking than the United States is right now.
Yeah. Right? So indigenous communities have been moving and relocating, obviously not by choice, but yeah. I mean, anyone who respects science and sees what's happening is doing mitigation, adaptation, looking to resilience. But there's still a lot we could do. So if you're listening to this, right. We also, there's a lot, these everyday practices.
It's often cheaper and more effective to solve the problem now.
Yeah.
They're doing these carbon sequestration. Yeah, but if we just don't put it up in the atmosphere, it's way, way cheaper.
Yeah. Jimmy Carter message in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
Conservation is actually more energy efficient than getting more fuel, right? Which makes sense because you're conserving. But literally at the time of the Arab oil embargo in the 70s, we could have made our houses more fuel efficient and saved every drop of oil we brought from the Persian Gulf. We wouldn't have needed a drop of it, right? So you inspired your kids. When we come back from the break, we will have heard from someone who inspired you.
Hi, I'm Mark Leeds, and I am pretty much having my mind blown to think that Christina Jarvis, whose work I so admire, picked me as this mentoring type for her. Yes, I've devoted my life to studying the works of Kurt Vonnegut, and by the time the second edition of my encyclopedia was finished, it was more than 33 years, and we were friends for 20 years. But I was sort of working in obscurity when I was in Barnstable, Massachusetts, and it was my first time there, and I did not know who Christina was, but she was obvious in the audience there. When we finished our talk, she came storming up to the podium, and she introduced herself very quickly, very chatty, and she goes, "You're the Mark Leeds." And that was the first time in my life anybody had said to me, "You're the Mark Leeds." I didn't know anybody knew of me at that point except, 12 people. So this was rather shocking. And she had this idea for a book. And as chatty as she was and explaining how she got there and getting off the highway, she was very nervous. I remember this. But we finally got to speak, and she outlined for me this idea for a book at the time. I'm going to leave it untitled for the moment, because when she first introduced the idea to me, it was all about the environment, and there was a ton of stuff there. I thought it was great, and she told me some of the other things that she had done and what she was hoping to produce out of this book. She was the first one who spoke to me as if I needed to give her approval for going ahead with her work, and I was rather shocked by that. I had never been in that position before. But it was clear from the work that I did previous to that with other authors, particularly Peter Reed, I sort of knew the right questions to ask her about what she wanted to do, and she had it all. And I think that when she went with Seven Stories and Dan Simon as her editor, he just helped her make it an incredibly strong book, so much so that I think that Christina Jarvis's work is one of three essential books that Vonnegutians need to have today. I think the work that Christina did opens up a whole new world concerning Vonnegut and his activism, which some have always criticized as only being in writing and a little bit too passive in person. It's probably half true. But along with her book, Lucky Mud and Other Foma, which is like the best name ever, there is Ginger Strand's book, The Brothers Vonnegut, which really grounds one in Kurt's pretty intimate understanding of the sciences and the scientists who think about existential questions like, can we control the weather? Like his brother was attempting to do. And you can really see the scientific understanding of this son of an architect, the younger brother of a physicist. Science was, as much a part of their his upbringing, but not on a mathematical level, on an understanding level, on a theoretical basis. He would understand things. And then there's the work by Peter Fries, the third book, The Clown of Armageddon, which I forgot how many pages it is, but it's worth the 800 pages or whatever it is, has to be the most revealing text of an author's private, intimate knowledge of the world through books, through classics, through the Bible, through Shakespeare, through Chaucer. I mean, Peter Fries does such a wonderful tracing of the literary roots of Vonnegut, despite the fact that we all know he never did graduate. His wife, Jane, helped educate him as much as anybody else. She was the humanities person and got him to read, the Brothers Karamazov on their honeymoon. So, I see Christina now as having entered that three-legged stool of Vonnegut scholarship between Jarvis, Strand, and Fries. And I think that those three books especially help reveal tremendous amounts about Vonnegut's mind. So thank you for this.
Welcome back. I'm Max Goller with Sacred Legions again. And I have with me Christina and her husband Tom and my co-host Pat. So we heard what Mark had to say about you. And we asked you, for someone who had inspired you, why was Mark Leeds the person that you felt most inspired you?
Well, first of all, I have to say, for anyone who has read Lucky Mutt and Other FOMA, this book would not exist, or my Vonnegut path would not have happened without Mark Leeds. He, in the Vonnegut world, in his made-up religion, Bokanonism, he would be a vindit, a personal shove in the direction of something. I actually had gotten quite away from Kurt Vonnegut's writings, but I had published on Slaughterhouse-Five when I was just first starting my career. But then after Kurt Vonnegut passed away, it was Mark Leeds who invited me to join the Kurt Vonnegut Society. And as strange as that might be, I took that seriously. I was like, oh, I am a member of the Kurt Vonnegut Society. I should teach more courses on him. So I actually taught a Vonnegut and Twain seminar. And I'll spare your listeners the whole rambling story of how it turned into the book and the research. But very early in my process, and it was sort of like a leap of faith. Kurt talks about, you know, the need to jump off cliffs and develop your wings on the way down. I just sort of took a plunge into a whole new direction. And I saw that Mark Leeds had, he wrote the Vonnegut Encyclopedia. He has an encyclopedic knowledge. He co-authored and co-edited multiple collections and, you know, was this amazing, towering figure in Vonnegut.
And a personal friend, which is, we're all jealous of the fact that they were personal friends.
Kurt wrote this beautiful introduction. And anyway, I was at the early stages of my research, and I just have to say I have an imposter syndrome. So I never feel like I belong anywhere. And there was a Vonnegut Festival in Barnstable, which is where Kurt Vonnegut lived for nearly two decades and did a lot of his writing on Cape Cod. Yes. And anyway, I showed up in Barnstable and Mark Leeds was there. And it's like I had all this Vonnegut knowledge in my head. I had spent time working with his manuscripts at the Lilly Library, but I hadn't met another Vonnegut scholar yet. And I just like blathered, and I'm like, "Hi, you're Mark Leeds. You wrote the encyclopedia, and I have a goldfish named Kilgour Trout. And I think about Kilgour Trout, and I've missed my exit on the thruway because I think so much about Vonnegut. And I'm just like this rambling, crazy person." And Mark, without missing a beat, was like, "Oh, welcome to the cross." But from then, he was very nurturing and supportive all the way through. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is how lonely writing a book could be, especially if it's very research intensive. But all through the process, Mark would just send these very kind emails, and he would connect me to younger Vonnegut scholars. And he would just say the warmest, kindest things, which itself is a type of secular sainthood. And but the day that he pronounced me fluent in Vonnegut, I was like, I have arrived. But he was just so nurturing and kind and wonderful. And of course, he shared stories about Kurt, which were very important to me and along the process, and that firsthand knowledge, and knowing, because if you're going to invest that kind of time in a project like this, you want to get it right. You want to really feel like you're, you know, capturing a person. But I never met Kurt Vonnegut.
Well, so this is interesting because I wasn't there when you met Mark Leeds, and none of us were there when Mark Leeds met Kurt. But it sounds like Kurt treated Mark just the way Mark treated you.
Yes.
When you hear the Mark stories, he wrote to him and said, I want to do my PhD dissertation on you. And Kurt didn't throw the letter away. He didn't ignore him. He didn't write back and say, nice kid, have a good time. He embraced him. And it sounds like that Mark Leeds in turn embraced you.
Absolutely.
Which is this sort of falling waters way of the world in Vonneguthood.
Right? Absolutely.
The crevasse is just more overflowing with love and affection and support and inclusion. And that's how the crevasse gets bigger.
And that was one of the reasons, although it might seem weird beginning with the acknowledgments, but throughout writing the book from start to finish from Mark Leeds, I felt like there's a character in Slapstick who makes this journey across the country, Melanie, to see her grandfather, and all the members of her artificial extended family, all the Orioles, are amazingly kind to her throughout the whole process. So all these people who knew Kurt, you know, whether it was Mark Leeds or Dan Wakefield who, just all of Kurt's own crevasse, were so kind and generous and giving. And I think it says a lot about who Vonnegut was. You know, he has that phrase, we are who we pretend to be, so we must be very careful who we pretend to be. Well, all Vonnegut scholars and superfans that I've ever met pretend to be or are amazingly kind, decent people.
Yeah.
So there must be something about his writing that brings out those kinds of connections, which is why this podcast and Secular Saints starting from this point makes tremendous sense, because Kurt was always recognizing, you know, our shared humanity, you know, our basic goodness. My favorite quote about Kurt Vonnegut was, Kurt Vonnegut saw us for who we really are and loved us anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was Jay Rentilli. I wish I had written that. But I think it captures him.
And I want to bring up, we have discussed, I'm counting like the number of books that have references now. I encourage you to read Kurt Vonnegut. A lot of the references that are most obscure come from the book Cat's Cradle. That was my personal favorite. I would recommend that one to anyone. I do want to ask Christina, so with all these books that we're throwing around about Kurt Vonnegut, is there a book that you feel is most important to you in his canon of writing?
Well, first I want to say to your listeners, the right Kurt Vonnegut book is the book that speaks to you at your particular moment. So there's no one right book for everyone. But I will always champion Galapagos, which is his most environmentally focused book. I can't even begin to describe it, but it's set a million years in the future, and it looks at what human beings have become or evolved into. But simultaneously, there's another narrative that looks at how we are in 1986 AD. And spoiler, we are not treating the planet very well, you know, between warfare and globalization and everything we're doing. But in the novel, I don't want to spoil it, it's actually about the Anthropocene and how we are acting on the planet with a geological force. But it's also terribly funny in how we are reduced. Yeah. Let's just say, in terms of how humans evolve, they take away our most destructive capabilities. So we lose the parts of our big brains and our hands that could wage war and enslave people. And it's very humbling. There's also a wonderful religious Eden thread and he simulates evolution and deep time in the novel. There's so much going on. It's completely brilliant.
And if you didn't think that George H.W. Bush could be funny, you're in for a treat. I mean, literally, it's 1986, so it's the George H.W. Bush administration, and it's real. It's hysterical. It's a great book. Tom, yeah, are you a Vonnegut fan?
I'm a huge Vonnegut
fan. Dare we ask? Okay, so yeah. What book do you recommend?
I always tell people to start with Cat's Cradle, because it's the book that I read first. And,
it's the book I read first, and I always tell people never read Cat's Cradle because scary.
So I got to bring this up.
So beautiful.
Cat's
Cradle was my favorite Vonnegut.
Yeah,
period. It just spoke to me because of some religious trauma here and there, but it just spoke to me. And so I mentioned that to Pat probably when you did a tour of the museum, and you were like, I wouldn't read Kurt Vonnegut for a while after that because it was so scary to me. And I'm like, oh my God, that was my favorite book. But then when you revisited, I don't even know what it was, Slaughterhouse maybe, you found another book that resonated with you, and then you were off to the races.
Yeah, I think I read Cat's Cradle when I was 13. And the last thing you want to think about is something that, like, anyway. But I don't want to ruin the book for anybody. But then I read Slaughterhouse-Five, which obviously is quite depressing. It's about the bombing of Dresden. But that had already happened. I didn't have to worry about it necessarily happening again.
Right.
But I think, not to be contrarian or anything, that if you like short stories, he has a lot of collections of short stories that might make it easy for you to like have that first taste of Kurt. Welcome to the Monkey House, maybe, you know, which is some really great short stories. But I love Hocus Pocus. I think that's my favorite, but it's hard to say.
As an artist, I'm going to recommend Bluebeard because, you know, he's got this artist who uses this special paint, probably a DuPont paint, that after a certain time fails and all of his paintings
Satin Duralux
fall off the canvas. Yes. And it's an amazing novel. Very fun.
Yeah. It's interesting. We talked about the first Vonnegut we read and our favorite. So I did my favorite. But my first Vonnegut book was his autobiographical book, and I'm blanking on the name, but
Palm Sunday
was the first Vonnegut I read, and it was all very autobiographical about his family in Indianapolis and all these different things that were just very true to him. And that got me into Vonnegut because, as the other people have mentioned, his sense of humor is beyond compare. We went to the Comedy Museum in Jamestown, New York today, and Kurt Vonnegut was put in as the favorite comedian of the group. And so I think that that is certainly what resonated with me and made me want to read more Vonnegut.
So when I read Vonnegut, I don't feel alone anymore. I feel like there's somebody in the room that gets me. And maybe I'm really flattering myself, but that's a nice feeling.
Yeah.
So if you got a minute, you can go to the library, pick up a copy of anything Vonnegut. I don't think you'll be disappointed.
And I'm going to break here because the whole point of Sacred Legions, Kurt Vonnegut serves as a patron saint, and for good reason. And this group that we have together certainly is a Vonnegut-centric group. But I do want to bring it back around to what the overall purpose is, which is that secular sainthood and providing resources for you listeners for volunteerism and self-care. And so one of the things that I will ask you, Christina, is what organization can I add to our clearinghouse of organizations to encourage people to either get involved in volunteerism or in their own self-care?
Well, I'm going to choose an organization that is local to me, which would be Greystone Nature Preserve. And I realize that many of your listeners will be to hell and gone from Greystone Nature Preserve, but that is a sacred place for me because not only planting trees and doing environmental education and experiential learning, but the founders embody some of the best parts of humanity. Diane Clark actually marched across the entire country bringing a peace pole to work to try and, you know, end nuclear war. You know, Bill Moran works with veterans. They work with our local BOCES, which is sort of like a technical. They work with adult learners with intellectual and developmental disabilities, bringing nature to them. But they are true healers and planetary citizens in the finest sense. But I would encourage your listeners to find their own local nature preserve. Not only, you know, is it wonderful and peaceful to do it, but I mean, one of the things for me about Kurt Vonnegut is, I mean, it's at that very local level of secular sainthood, but it's all connected. I mean, we're all here on this planet Earth, you know, and this unique, wonderful planet that supports life. But at the end of the day, you know, finding that local nature preserve, I think you will go to help heal the earth, but it's you who will be healed by the earth. Yeah. I am always restored whenever I go there.
Yeah. So a web search will find your local one. But the nice thing about the Sacred Legions website is you'll be able to, we'll have a link to this up on the yes. Sacred Legions website. So you don't have to run off and find this. And then if you are not local to Western New York, then yeah, try and find your own. If you find one and it's great, contact Max at the website and maybe we can add that other, you know, let's build a network of people who want and need and can help each other. And the other thing is, helping is no fun if it hurts. So I think when you talk to secular saints, and every single one of them you talk to, in my opinion, is doing something that makes them feel better. You're not suffering.
No.
When you do something to make sure the plan is more sustainable for your children, your grandchildren, and the seven generations after you, right? So people, I think being a good guy is a lot more work than it actually is, because what you need to do is find the good guy thing that makes you happy and then just do it. So if you're out there doing good guy things that make you happy, or good gal things or whatever, I don't gender, blah, gender's a construct, but just let us know. We'll share the information with other folks. And, you know, you're already a secular saint. You just haven't recognized it about yourself yet. So that's hopefully what this podcast is going to do, right?
And pointing that out, if you go to the website, sacredlegions.org, I already have a comment form. And I will get something a little more sophisticated as time goes on. But literally right now, you could put in your name, your email address, and a comment. And in the comments, if you just want to write, this is an organization that I think is worth volunteering for, or this is a person that I would like to see recognized as a secular saint and why, you're going to help build our resources to bring you further podcasts about people doing important things in the 12 separate categories that are listed on the website, so that we've got resources that cover global stewardship and healthcare and gun safety, that it's just a wide range of secular sainthood that we want to encourage. And we want you to be a part of that. We want you to contribute to that clearinghouse that people can go to so that they can find what they're passionate about and what they're interested in that matches their secular sainthood.
And don't be shy. If you're doing something good, you can nominate yourself. This isn't, I got to go find my Aunt Mildred to put my name in. Just let us know what you're doing, because as a person who sometimes is trying to do something to help somebody and I have to get out there the information that I'm trying to help somebody, a clearinghouse for that information would be helpful. So if you're doing good work and not enough people know about you, you can nominate yourself. It's all right. No, don't feel bad. No guilt.
Indeed. We want to recognize as many people as we can and certainly grow a resource for people to find things that they're interested in volunteering on.
Okay. So I have to throw in one last Kurt quote. It's actually from Sirens of Titan. This is a paraphrase, but as you talk about Sacred Legions, and I think sometimes people, you know, it's easy with doom scrolling and all the bad news and to kind of give in to the doom. But there's a quote in Sirens of Titan where he says, There's no good reason why good cannot triumph as often as evil. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of organization. If only angels could be organized along the lines of the mafia. That's a paraphrase.
Yeah.
So please, listeners, you know, join those mafia angels, join the sacred legions, because if enough get together, who knows what we can accomplish?
You know, I think part of the problem, just real quick, is that whole hide your lamp under a bushel baloney, right? Is if you're actually doing a good thing, you're supposed to be shy about it. The mafia is not shy because they're like, we're making money, we're making coin, we got some prostitutes, we got some drugs, we're going to make this all work, right? If we're shy about it, we're not going to make the cash. And we've got people doing really good stuff that are then taught, don't tell anybody what you're doing. Well, we're on the other side of that. We want to know.
I want and a Mafia Angels t-shirt.
Mafia Angels, excellent.
And this gives us the opportunity to get beyond the negative news cycles that exist everywhere and start sharing what we're doing that's good and that empower people. And then more people will want to do the same. And that's what it's all about. So I do want to thank all of you for listening today to the inaugural podcast. And I look forward to future episodes and sharing more interviews with people that are doing decent things in an indecent society.
Tom, beyond Christina, global. Thanks for joining us.
Yep. Thanks for having us.
And thank you for sharing the microphone with me. Pat LaMarche is a godsend in this. I have a former radio broadcaster. I have zero experience, as I'm sure is apparent, but it is such a joy to have someone that can support in this drive to increase secular sainthood amongst people.
Well, you're a saint yourself there, Max. I'd be crazy not to help.
Yes, and thank you both.
Ah, well, that's fun.
And thank the audience. That's what I always say.
Yes, thanks for being here. And watch the site.